From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Ukrainian troops prepare to leave their posts and Crimea as Vladimir Putin pushes forward with the peninsula's official embrace of Russia.
Sanctions should be merely an opening salvo that challenges Putin Inc. To help them understand the long-term costs and consequences of the actions in Crimea.
Also today, NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden reveals the government programme that has the power to vacuum up all phone calls in a foreign country, which could include millions from US citizens. And we hear from our correspondent in Nigeria as Islamist extremists continue their violent campaign against the country's students.
Boko Haram is specifically targeting high schools with Western values and schools that teach Western education.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Ukraine's government is drawing up plans to quickly and efficiently withdraw troops and their families from the base in Crimea, according to Kiev's defense chief. The move comes after a second Navy base was reportedly stormed by pro-Russian forces in western Crimea, just hours after troops captured the main Navy base in Sevastopol. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is traveling to Russia and Ukraine on a three-day visit for talks on the ongoing crisis. The Secretary General is due to have meetings with senior officials from both countries. Our UN correspondent in New York, Nick Harper, says the trip comes at the same time the Security Council tries to find a diplomatic solution.
Ban Ki-moon's trip coincides with another meeting by the UN Security Council to discuss Ukraine. Their meeting on Wednesday is the eighth time they've met since the escalation of the crisis 3 weeks ago. However, once again, no progress is expected, simply more talking from the 15-man council. On Saturday, Russia vetoed a draft resolution criticizing the Crimea referendum and calling for respect of Ukrainian territorial sovereignty. And with Russia standing in opposition to the rest of the council, a united voice will prove impossible.
In Washington, White House spokesperson Jay Carney has urged Russia to talk to Ukraine over the military base standoff in Crimea, saying Russian efforts to seize the bases is creating a dangerous situation.
Relations between Russia and the West are not in a good place right now.
The White House says the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigations is joining the search for missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370. The Malaysian government requested the FBI's help as some family members of the passengers go on hunger strike, frustrated that their loved ones remain missing. Priscilla Huff has an update from Washington.
The immediate focus for the FBI will be the flight simulator found in the home of pilot Captain Zahari Ahmad Shah. FBI investigators are confident they can recover all of the data from the flight simulator, even the deleted information, which some say is suspicious and others think was merely housekeeping. With the families begging for information, the U.S. has continued its own efforts to search for Malaysian Airlines Flight 370.
Presiding over her first U.S. Federal Open Market Committee meeting as chair, Janet Yellen says the Federal Reserve will continue to cut their asset purchase program. In their goal of achieving maximum employment, the new chair emphasized the Fed's commitment to strengthening the labor market. Fed Chief Yellen said the economic recovery of the U.S. continues, but a challenging winter hindered more robust growth.
Unusually harsh weather in January and February has made assessing the underlying strength of the economy especially challenging.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Japanese car giant Toyota has agreed to pay out $1.2 billion to settle a U.S. criminal probe over its handling of complaints relating to faulty vehicle acceleration. The settlement represents the largest criminal penalty imposed on a car company in U.S. history, as Nina Maria Potts reports.
The settlement means the U.S. Justice Department has agreed to drop the case against Toyota in exchange for the payout and the company's cooperation. The deal also requires the independent monitoring of how Toyota handles safety communications. For U.S. Justice Chief Eric Holder, a victory. For Toyota, the conclusion, it had intentionally misled consumers.
Toyota confronted a public safety emergency as if it were simply a public relations problem.
The settlement allows the Japanese carmaker to avoid criminal charges.
and British MPs say FIFA should consider stripping Qatar of its right to host the 2022 World Cup after allegations a former official received money from a firm linked to the country's hosting campaign. Qatar says its 2022 bid adhered to all of the World Football Governing Body's regulations. UK correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
Senior UK MPs say FIFA must launch a full inquiry into the allegations published by Britain's Telegraph newspaper. The chairman of the Parliamentary Sports Committee says the payments provide further evidence that casts doubts over the credibility of the process to select Qatar as 2022 host. The Telegraph claims former official Jack Warner and his family were paid almost $2 million by a firm linked to the successful campaign. The Qatar World Cup's already controversial because of the summer heat and likelihood it'll be moved to winter.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Ukraine is getting ready to withdraw its military personnel from Crimea. According to Ukrainian military officials, just 24 hours after President Vladimir Putin signed a treaty for the peninsula to join the Russian Federation. The annexation has already been met with targeted US sanctions, with White House spokesman Jay Carney today repeating the warning that Russia's actions will only result in greater isolation.
The so-called referendum and so-called annexation violate Ukrainian law, violate the Ukrainian constitution, are illegal under the United Nations Charter, and have not been and will not be recognized by the United States and other members of the international community.
After a defiant 24 hours from the Russian leader, I spoke to Damon Wilson, vice president at the Atlantic Council think tank, to find out if the US actually had a winning card to play against Mr. Putin.
What he wants to project is this sense of authority, power, and confidence. This was a man who has fully embraced a strategy of nationalism at home and in Russia's neighborhood as part of securing his own rule at home and making sure that folks stand up and pay attention to Russia on the international stage. So I think you've seen without a pause his direct movement into moving to annex Crimea, demonstrating that he understood the Western strategy was meant to deter and perhaps convince him to leave Crimea in a limbo that he has with Transnistria and Moldova, and he just plowed through that immediately. I think it absolutely underscores that we need to be in this for the long haul about how to actually affect his strategic calculations and standing up with a more forceful response to aggression in Europe's east.
Vladimir Putin dismisses the West's line that his actions have been illegal or have in some way infringed on international law. Who's right on this? Who's got the international law book? Who's reading it upside down here, Russia or the US? Because Vladimir Putin seems to think everything he's doing is well within his rights. And with that in mind, what do you think his next move could be?
I mean, there's no question here. This is a bald challenge to the entire international legal order that has provided a sense of stability, peace, and security, certainly in the Euro-Atlantic area, if not globally. And to have Russia seize by force a chunk of territory of a neighboring state, this is Saddam Hussein in Kuwait, this is Hitler in Sudetenland, these are acts of bald aggression, which have no place in standing for countries that are committed to holding up the sense of international justice and international legal order. What he's clearly shown is that he has no pretense of even needing to be able to follow these norms and is willing to pursue his objectives of dominating his neighbors, keeping them within Moscow's orbit, restoring a sense of Russian empire and prestige in the world through intimidation and fear rather than through admiration, and essentially declare war on the post-Cold War order in Europe. That's what he's unfolded in Crimea. This is not about Crimea. This is not about ethnic Russians in Ukraine. This is about Vladimir Putin and his statement to the West, his challenge to the West, if you will.
But Russia's annexation of Crimea seem to go through without any major hurdle whatsoever. Would it be the same case if he decided to make a move on eastern Ukraine?
Look, there's no doubt if Vladimir Putin decides that he wants to invade, destabilize, capture parts of Ukrainian territory, he has brute force on his side, and he can thuggishly maneuver his way through this. I think the challenge that we all face right now is doing everything we can to go big on supporting Ukraine, supporting Ukraine's government, both financially, economically, politically, diplomatically, and also militarily. It's time to put that equation on the table. Ukraine does not enjoy an Article 5 guarantee of its security that NATO members enjoy. Yet we're short-sighted if we think that what's happening in Crimea, what's happening in Ukraine, doesn't directly affect American interest or NATO interest. And so I think there's a role to be played to think about how we can support Ukraine across the board, because the best way to defeat Vladimir Putin is not to go into headlong military confrontation. That would be devastating for Ukraine, for the people of Ukraine, for their long-term interest. He's got bigger muscles to flex, if you will, than those that he would face in Ukraine. The best way to defeat Vladimir Putin is to play for the long haul and ensure that Ukraine not only survives this, but that it thrives, and it actually, at this second chance, thrives as a free market democracy that's increasingly integrated into Europe and draws closer to NATO over time.
Damon Wilson, Vice President at the Atlantic Council think tank. This is FSN Reports. Flight simulator files deleted by one of the pilots of missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 are now part of the FBI's investigation into the fate of the jet and its 239 passengers and crew. Earlier reports that a low-flying aircraft had been spotted in the Maldives were swiftly dismissed by Malaysian authorities. As theories build, so does the size of the search effort, with 26 nations looking for the Boeing 777 across an area the size of Australia. For the most recent developments, I spoke to Jeff Wise, aviation journalist with Slate.com.
I mean, as this case drags on and the relevant information seems increasingly hard to come by, we have these tidbits and crumbs that emerge that move the ball forward a little bit. Sometimes they seem to contradict earlier information. It's very hard to understand what is going on here. I would say that some possibilities have been, if not entirely ruled out, come to seem exceedingly unlikely. And by that I mean especially the idea that this was an accident. There's been, in this absence of hard information, an explosion of theories, some of them pretty far-fetched, some of them quite reasonable or at least difficult to rule out. One that I wrote about yesterday that it still is very big on the Internet, this idea that there was a cockpit fire and the pilot was trying to reach the island of Langkawi. I think that essentially has been ruled out by the evidence available right now.
One of the most recent theories, Jeff, is that the plane was actually spotted in the Maldives, southwest of the capital. What are Malaysian authorities saying about this idea?
Well, you know, the Malaysian government formally inquired to the Maldive government, asking them, is this true? And they formally said, no, it's not. You know, this is an island. It's a fairly small body of land. I think it's a fairly straightforward matter to rule it out. I mean, I wasn't expecting it to be true anyway, because on Saturday, the Malaysian government, the Prime Minister indeed himself of Malaysia, had said that due to the analysis of satellite pings, they were able to establish that at 8:11 a.m. on the morning of the plane's disappearance, Saturday, March 8th, the plane must have arrived at some location somewhere on these two arcs, the one over the southern Indian Ocean, the other running through Central Asia. So it must have been in one of those two places. So the Maldives are not on either of those arcs.
The focus of this investigation has recently moved towards the pilots of Flight MH370. I know today we're seeing reports of the flight simulators of one of those pilots being pored over and suggestions that perhaps some data has been deleted. But is that unusual?
Well, you know, of course, no. I mean, anybody who runs any kind of computer program probably finds themselves deleting files all the time. You know, this guy had a setup with computer screens and controllers and so forth that was pretty elaborate and expensive looking, but you could run it from any computer. You know, you just need to plug the jack into a computer. And he had various laptops. He took a laptop with him, as I understand it. So it would have been a fairly straightforward matter to just have the software on different computers. And, you know, if you can imagine somebody has a browser history that they might control. You know, a lot of us might not want people to know what we're doing, apart from hijacking planes. And you know, by the same token, I think if this person had was intending to carry out a plot which would result in an international investigation, it wouldn't be a big stretch of the imagination that he would do that in a way that you could either take the files away or delete them in a way that couldn't be recovered.
Jeff Wise, aviation journalist with Slate.com. Now, documents leaked this week by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden reveal a previously secret government program that has the power to vacuum up all the phone calls in a foreign country and store them for up to a month. This could include millions of calls to and from US citizens. On the heels of this new report, the Independent Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board held a public meeting in Washington today, where they grilled officials from the NSA, FBI and Office of National Intelligence about whether they have sufficient limits in place to prevent them from violating the Constitution. Our DC correspondent Alice Olstein reports.
The National Security Agency developed a program called Mystic, complete with the logo of a wizard brandishing a staff topped with a cell phone, that has the capacity to record every single call made within or to a foreign country over a 30-day period. Starting in 2009, the agency began developing a list that swelled to 6 target countries, though which countries those are is still unknown. Using another program called Retro, the government can go back in time and listen to specific calls, including ones to and from U.S. citizens, and put clips into long-term storage.
There's reason to believe now that if you have relatives overseas, if you talk about foreign affairs, you could be flagged by the NSA or other government officials.
That's attorney Michelle Richardson with the American Civil Liberties Union, which is currently suing the government for refusing to disclose information about government surveillance programs. She said there's still a lot the public needs to know so they can evaluate the legality and impact of current practices.
How is this information used? We have some documents now, thanks to Edward Snowden, that show there are very lax rules about what happens to all of this very sensitive data after it ends up in these NSA databases. We need much more information about what different agencies have access to it, how they can use it, like for criminal prosecutions or immigration enforcement or regulatory uses, and really whether people will ever find out the government has and uses this information against them.
The ACLU also testified Wednesday at a public hearing of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, a group set up by President Obama last year to review the government's many surveillance programs and recommend reforms. The board spent more than an hour questioning officials from the NSA, FBI, and Office of National Intelligence about what kinds of information they're currently collecting and what they're doing with that data. NSA attorney Rajesh Day told the panel that they collect communications both from companies like Verizon and Comcast and from what he called upstream.
Upstream collection refers to collection from the, for lack of a better phrase, internet backbone rather than internet service providers. It is also, however, selector-based, i.e. based on particular phone numbers or emails, things like phone numbers or emails. This is collection to, from, or about selectors.
Day and the other government officials at the hearing assured the board that there are adequate legal restrictions on when and why they can go back through all the information they've collected, and they said they're obligated to purge any communications from U.S. citizens if it has no foreign intelligence value. But many civil liberties advocates present at the hearing, including Richardson's fellow ACLU attorney Jamil Jaffer, said that wasn't enough.
There is nothing to prevent the government from recording every phone call, copying every email, creating a permanent record of everybody's movements, associations, and communications. And the only question we'll be asking is, when can the government access it? But the creation of that kind of massive database will have huge implications for the way that ordinary people operate in society, both the way that they interact with one another and the way that they interact with their government. People who believe that the government is surveilling every movement and every communication, believe justifiably that it's doing it, will act differently. They won't go to controversial websites and they won't engage in controversial communications that are necessary for any democracy.
Privacy advocates also raised concerns about comments made at the hearing by another NSA official, Brad Wegman, who told the panel the agency believes querying its massive database of communications is not a search and thus doesn't violate the Fourth Amendment. He warned the board that it would be too burdensome to make them establish probable cause and get a warrant from a neutral judge every time they wanted to pull up someone's data, which civil liberties advocates have recommended. Panel member Patricia Wald countered that inconvenience to the agency shouldn't be their standard for establishing constitutional limits. When Congress returns to D.C. next week, some lawmakers will continue pushing both for the warrant requirement and other sweeping reforms to government surveillance programs. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, a 500-strong delegation has come together in the Nigerian capital this week with a number of challenges that could significantly shape the country's future. Africa's most populous nation is divided along ethnic, religious, and linguistic lines, with many pushing for controversial talks over a potential breakup, along with possible secession. Islamist-linked violence and rampant corruption over the nation's oil reserves will also dominate. Our correspondent in Nigeria is Gary Alfonso, and he spoke to me from the capital, Abuja, earlier.
This national conference in Abuja, in the heart of Nigeria, is probably the most significant gathering of leaders from all kinds of sectors, not only in the political sphere, but also the economic, the social, and people from grassroots level, basically looking at solutions for the Nigerian political problems starting to build ahead of the 2015 elections. And this gathering, funnily enough, has been adjourned in order to address a couple of serious rules, and those rules being that people in the north and people in the south don't adhere to the same kind of traditional and religious opening rules to conferences and stuff like that. So already so early into a conference, it looks like the elephant in the room is the thing that is the really dominating things, and that elephant being secession talks in Nigeria about whether or not the north and the south should remain one country in Nigeria because they are fundamentally different.
Gary, another issue gripping Nigeria is that of Islamic extremism. And I read today that Nigeria's northeastern Borno state is closing all high schools because of the threat posed by Boko Haram. The situation there is seriously, surely it's coming to a head now.
It's absolutely coming to a head, and the numbers of killings in the north in Borno state. There are three states in the north that have been declared emergency areas, and I've just been in one of them for about 3 weeks, and it's almost impossible to be economically active in areas like that. So the Boko Haram influence on the eastern and northeastern side of Nigeria is really, truly horrific. And the manner in which they're attacking indiscriminately, and the reason why high schools were closed specifically is because Boko Haram is specifically targeting the high schools with Western values and schools that teach Western education. So and that's the only rule that Boko Haram seems to be applying, is that any Western education is a bad thing and they want to eradicate it. And that's the pressure they're putting on local authorities. The national authorities and the army and the military in Nigeria are trying to battle it and are not getting as far ahead as they would like to in that conflict. And then finally, the people in those regions are also under pressure because there is seemingly, because of the religious differences, some people who are thinking of, Sharia law in those areas, but by far the majority don't. But it is a conflict that is starting to make inroads into normal society.
Our apologies for the interference on the line from our correspondent Gary Alfonso in Nigeria during that interview. and staying on the African continent. With a ceasefire failing to stop the fighting in South Sudan, there are now warnings the country is heading for another crisis, this time famine. The United Nations Security Council has again met to discuss the worsening situation. Nick Harper reports from the UN headquarters in New York.
From fighting to famine, South Sudan is on the brink of being unable to feed its population. Conflict broke out in December, and a recent ceasefire has done little to end the fighting. It means crops have simply not been planted. The UN humanitarian coordinator in South Sudan, Toby Lanza, worries time is running out.
If the planting season couldn't happen, or if it were lost, well, then there won't be a harvest, and it should be plainly obvious to the leaders and to the different communities in South Sudan what that really spells.
How are they managing?
Lanza has spent time touring the camps where thousands now live. These are people who fled their homes to escape the fighting and are now sheltering inside UN bases around the country or living rough. Thousands have been killed in the turmoil that's overtaken the country, and over 800,000 displaced. The UN estimates that just under 5 million people are already in need of humanitarian assistance, and the fear is that figure could rise. The rainy season is fast approaching, and the UN is struggling to get much-needed food supplies into the country ahead of the rains. Here's Toby Lanza.
The challenge here is immense, and we're really up against it, so I'm counting on the goodwill of the international community, the goodwill of the donor community, to stand with South Sudan in its greatest hour of need.
As you would recall, Madam President, UNMISS was...
At the United Nations in New York, the Security Council met to discuss what is being described as a deteriorating situation. The head of peacekeeping operations, Hervé Ladsous, said with fighting continuing, it's only likely to get worse.
Both parties continue to prioritize the pursuit of military gains over talks towards a comprehensive political settlement. And the crisis has already affected the security of the region. The longer it goes on, the chances for further regional intervention will actually grow.
The UN is now sending monitoring teams to six conflict areas to assess alleged human rights violations. The executive director of UN Women, Phumzile Mlambo-Nuka, told the Security Council things were especially bad for the female population.
Women and girls have been exposed to heightened levels of violence and crime, including sexual and gender-based violence. I was appalled at the conditions of those living in the protection sites. The onset of the rainy season has exacerbating and is already bringing about a critical situation. The density of the people in living spaces was 13 times the recommended humanitarian minimum.
In December, the Security Council voted to increase the number of peacekeepers to 12,500. That was meant to be just a temporary measure. The Secretary-General, Ban Ki-moon, however, is now recommending that that number remains in South Sudan for at least the next 12 months. The only problem, they haven't yet all arrived in the country, and the latest UN estimates suggest they won't until well into the second half of this year. Nick Harper at the United Nations in New York.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. And you can get in touch with us via Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Thursday, our roundup of the top US stories alongside our international features continues. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Hume on the bulletin desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.